Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Weekly Critic podcast. I am Ben Sixsmith, and with me today, I'm delighted to say, is David Butterfield. David Butterfield is the literary editor of The Critic, but today we're not going to talk about books. We're going to talk instead about music. David wrote a piece for our last edition that was called A Tale of Two Glastos and was an account of his experiences at the 2023 Glastonbury Music Festival. But let's go back in time a little bit first. David, what was your first music festival?
Hello, Ben. Thank you for inviting me to talk about something a little different. My first festival was when I was 16 or so, and that would be Leeds 2001. Reading and Leeds, as you know, do a sort of late August musical festival, which is not as old as Glastonbury, but has a good sort of 30 years behind it as a music festival.
Who was headlining in 2001?
That was the year, I mean, it's taking us back, isn't it? There was the Mannix, Travis, and I think Eminem was headlining on one of the nights, but those weren't the people I was interested in. I was much more interested in those days in the likes of Annual Knows by the Trail of the Dead, Eels, who else? Kids Near Water was a little band I was into, Arab Strap, these kind of things. So it was a good first dive into the world of the festival.
I think it's very unfair to put Eminem up against Travis. I mean, how could he possibly compete?
I think he was a little bewildered by the affair, but there we go.
And when was your first Glastonbury?
That would be a couple of years later in 2003. That was the year of REM, Radiohead, not as good as Radiohead 97, which we all know, but a good show nonetheless. Granddaddy, I remember seeing. So I was about 18 at that time.
Festivals, at the risk of sounding too pretentious, they're not just events. They have this place in the national consciousness, and especially Glastonbury. It's something that international people would know England for, and it's also just a part of our national story in a sense. Why do you think it's become so important to British culture and above and beyond all other music festivals?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think it's a mixture of two things. One is the fact it's so old and well established. It's now over 50 years old, the first having been in 1970. And secondly, it's sort of taken over the legacy of the great festivals of the late 60s and early 70s. You know, Woodstock 69 was effectively a one-off. There was this awful attempt in 1999 to recreate it, and it sort of created an anti-Woodstock. There was the Isle of Wight Festival for a few years in the late 60s, early 70s. But all of that sort of countercultural movement faded away by the 70s. But after a gap in the mid-1970s, Glastonbury, under Michael Eavis, was able to forge a roughly annual fixture, which has sort of heralded the beginning of the summer festival season for half a century now. The fact that TV crews came in a big way in the mid-90s on Channel 4 and then the BBC has made it a festival that is enjoyed remotely, as well as by now 200,000 or so who make it down to the farm.
What do you think gave it that kind of staying power? Because as someone who's grown up with it just always being on, and I'm sure you've grown up with it always being on as well, it almost feels like just a natural part of the calendar, like it just kind of spontaneously occurs. But obviously the level of planning and organization and funding that goes into it is astronomical, especially now, but also in the past. So what has allowed it to endure?
Well, internally, the fact that it continues to be a great success, if judged by ticket sales and by turning a seven-figure profit, but sort of washing its face each year at a scale of 200,000 attendees. But it's always there in our lives, in the sense that, depending on how old you are and what your tastes are, most people can picture Pulp playing in 95 or Radiohead in 97 or Bowie in 2000, or even sort of widening the musical canon, Jay-Z 2008, Beyonce 2011. There are these iconic moments, particularly on the pyramid stage where the headliners perform, which somehow appeal to almost all musical tastes in the country and beyond. And there's just an expectation that Glastonbury will be there for us, even despite the fact that in some years they have a fallow year to sort of let the farm recover, or at least that's the tale. I don't think the farm actually does much recovering at all. But yeah, it's something we can't really imagine the summer being without. It's a fixture to stay.
Absolutely. Like you say, it emerged from this kind of 90s, 70s counterculture. But you're right in your piece that now it has a more kind of, maybe the right word is confused identity. What were your impressions of Glastonbury 2023?
A very mixed bag. I wasn't going there thinking either on the one hand that it would be a life-changing immersion into a festival I hadn't visited for a while, nor on the other hand was I planning to criticise it and pick it apart. But I was really quite shocked by the divide that has now emerged between two very different sorts of festival goers, which the organisers, it's now Michael Eavis' daughter, Emily, who is in charge, but that they're trying to keep the two peaceably together as though everyone's in it together. But it's just not the case, Ben. We've got almost a diurnal and a nocturnal culture of festival goers. The former are there very much for the live musical performances. 60-odd stages are doing that in the day, and that they live by a much more sort of leisured pace throughout the day, disappearing for the most part at night. Whereas there's a flip side to that culture who are very much there for the club scene, the dancing, and that typically kicks off about 11 or 12 p.m. and goes through to dawn. And naturally, that crowd isn't very active in the day. Sort of rolled into that, there's a very heavy drug culture, but not drugs of the 70s and 80s kind, which would sort of let your day flow by as you recline in front of the big stages. Rather, drugs that are going to give you the sort of narrative arc up and down that will get you through a long club night. And those two groups don't really have anything in common beyond the general fact that they're there to hear some music.
They're very different kinds of music and a very different experience of that music as well. I mean, I'm hesitant to ask this question almost because I feel that it'll have kind of snobbish connotations, but that's not my intention in asking it. But traditionally, the latter, this kind of club scene, doesn't feel as though it has such deep roots in Glastonbury. Is this a newer phenomenon? I mean, I really don't know.
Yeah, it's very, very much a new phenomenon. I mean, to go back historically, in the 1980s, there effectively wasn't dance music at Glastonbury. But by the late 80s, early 90s, the illegal rave scene is becoming a very big part of UK culture. And a lot of house music is sort of being played around the festival unofficially. But the breakthrough comes in 1994 when Orbital, their pyramid stage, actually NME stage set, is broadcast by Channel 4. And suddenly that opens up the idea that electronic music and dance can have a place at Glastonbury. The year after, in 1995, a dance village is set up, and now at an industrial scale, there's two sites, two areas on Worthy Farm, which are devoted solely to the club scene. And that's only grown year by year. And the fact that the festival is twice as large as it was 20 odd years ago, it is almost entirely driven by rising numbers of those there for the club scene. And there's a demographic element to that. So I don't think it's anything of a snobbish kind, of a class kind whatsoever, but the average festival goer at Glasto is about 40 years old, so a little older than me. But there's a big sort of demographic hole. There aren't many people between sort of 18 and 25, you know, so students don't appear to be heading there. But then there's a big block, sort of 25 to 35 year olds, who are mostly there for the dance scene. Whereas those watching live music are probably, on average themselves, getting closer to 50. And they're trying to relive, I think, the spirit that they might have known in the 20s, i.e. at a Glasto of the 90s. And these two groups really don't appear to have much in common. There's no connecting sense of festival spirit that I could discern.
Polarization is a very kind of modish term nowadays, especially when we're talking about politics. If you're talking about Brexit in the UK or Trump in the US, I mean, this does seem like a kind of polarization of a very different kind. How do you think it's developed? This is obviously, it could have implications far broader in terms of the music industry now. But why is it the case that these people who go to see the live bands skew significantly older than the young people who are going to take certain, not necessarily legal substances and dance the night away?
Yeah, it's a difficult one to pin down. I mean, I think the easiest way to answer that is that the live music scene now is in a very different place from where it was 20 years ago and even where it was 5 years ago. So it is simply harder to be in your 20s now and have grown up with a very active first-hand knowledge of live music, not just at festivals, but on the gig scene, wherever you live, etc. Whereas, you know, dance music can pretty much be had in any city around the world. As for those that are older, well, they have grown up with a relationship with live music and are largely at Glastonbury to try and recreate that. And I guess for reasons of age, they're less well represented on the club floor at 4 a.m.
Less well represented, but from my limited experience of clubs, still occasionally.
Oh, yes. No,
very enthusiastically represented.
Absolutely. But this particular divide, which is really one of taste and the way you handle the festival, is separate from a different group, which I touched upon in the piece, which is the sort of heart of the Glastonbury ethos, namely in an area called the Healing Fields. There's a sort of ghetto of the sorts of people that the average person thinks goes to Glastonbury. Mm. So it's a lazy term, but the hippie culture generally is still well represented in this inner community of maybe 5 or 10,000 people who are spending their days talking to each other about pacifism, alternative modes of energy, spiritual healing, all the sorts of stuff you'd expect. But what's so odd is that not only do they not really engage with the festival that surrounds them, but what the festival is doing, especially in terms of its corporate and capitalist elements, and in terms of its environmental harm, is actually antithetical to the things that they are there to try and sort of preach. So it's a really weird mixture, Glastonbury 2023.
Yeah, I like the part in your essay where you talk about these kind of natural spaces, which are just these kind of tiny little indents of wildlife almost, yes, on this giant sea of mud and plastic that the festival's become. But like you say, somehow they've still kept alive that image. Like, as someone who's never been to Glastonbury, I can kind of imagine someone in this multicolored woolen poncho stumbling around the enchanted.
Yeah, they're there, but what's sad is that they're almost visited by the rest of the festival as an exhibit. Mm. People will, you know, between gigs or whatever, they will head over to the Healing Fields to see what they're up to and sort of tour through and take photos and then get back to what for the most part is like any other festival in the world in terms of how it handles food, drink, and the like.
You write in your piece, a genuinely countercultural, performance-driven, people-powered festival can be resurrected. What makes you optimistic enough to say that?
Well, I guess it all comes down to the can, doesn't it? I'm optimistic insofar as it is not rocket science to get good bands to play good music attended by people who have a shared experience of it. I mean, that is very easily done. The question is, how do you scale that up in a way that doesn't fall into the obvious pitfalls of most festivals? And I think the answer is simply to look at Glastonbury as it stands now and to reverse all of the things that seem to go against its spirit. So you would start with something small. You would probably limit it in its earlier days just to live music, which means performed live music. So there'd be less of the dance going on. And so long as the tickets weren't prohibitively expensive and the venture wasn't driven by profit, I think soon enough there would be a sense that the festival is about shared experience of live music rather than anything you can get elsewhere. So that's not really a sophisticated answer, but I think were the will there to go back to basics, it wouldn't take much effort for things to scale up. Of course, you're not going to get massive headliners who these days often want a seven-figure rather than a six-figure fee, but you wouldn't need to. That wouldn't be the nature of it. These bands are now touring at a stadium scale, so the festival wouldn't need to be the place where you catch them.
Yeah, I mean, almost by then, the nature of their performance, it would detract from the kind of spirit that you're aiming to create. I see what you're saying. I mean, I guess the problem is that the music industry more broadly is struggling to such an extent that kind of creativity is going against the tide. I mean, there are various reasons for that, of course, but one of the more startling that you mentioned in your piece, you write, the UK music industry is now a third smaller than it was before the pandemic. We saw figures at the weekend that the economy in general, is recovering post-pandemic, but maybe not the music industry. What kind of factors are holding it back from a broader recovery?
Yeah, it's a shocking statistic that. And if I move from optimism to pessimism now, I genuinely don't think the UK music scene will return to the size it was pre-pandemic. I think some things there are permanently lost. The question is what can be done to mitigate its decreasing even further. There's two main angles to that. One is straightforward record sales, and the other is the live music venue. When it comes to record sales, we as you know, we're moving away from the traditional model of trying to get signed and then getting a record deal and then the record company marketing it and you're, you know, working your way up the charts, as it were. That is becoming scarcer for most new acts. Instead, in a world of digital music where you can self-release and get yourself on Spotify and the other streaming services, you can get your sound out, but you're not likely to make much money from it very quickly. So we have this real gap between the young talent wanting to make music and their being able to make meaningful money from it. And it's only a chance few who somehow get picked out on YouTube or whatever it may be, who then break through to the record company model. So we're simply seeing less money go to artists and therefore less money entering into the system from music listeners. As for live music, the venues are just decreasing, you know, by the week. At my day, in your day, it wasn't just the case that any town or city would have two or three places which are devoted to live music, but the pub circuit more generally would very commonly book bands, have support acts beneath them, and it was simply an easy thing to wander out on a given evening, find a place with live music and encounter bands that you'd never heard of. And the money, to my mind, just doesn't seem to be there for people to set up new small-scale live music events. So unless there's something of a kind whereby councils or maybe even breweries sponsor pubs and incentivize them to get some live music going, I really struggle to see how in a UK context the live music scene is going to grow again. The only growth we see is at the top level, where those artists, those bands that aren't really shifting the records as they used to, instead seek to make money from extremely expensive ticketed shows on a massive scale at the O2 Arena or these kind of things. So it really needs care to try and build things up again if we can.
Yeah, and I wonder how those two big problems feed into each other as well. I mean, there's an act you mentioned in the piece. Luckily for them, I can't remember the name. But they were playing Glastonbury, I think, for the first time. And I thought, well, yeah, I've never heard of these guys. So I looked up their Spotify and they had like, I don't know, maybe 30,000 listeners a month, which, you know, in people terms, that's quite kind of cool. Like 30,000 people, wow. But my understanding is that 1 million listens on Spotify, you get like max £2,000.
Right.
But yeah. If you work like 30,000, that's like, it's a trivial amount of money if you're trying to do it full time. And then, of course, you don't have the money to go on tour, to, you know, even go over to London. You're going to end up spending way more than you're going to make. So that kind of energy to create live music is also being diminished, even as those opportunities are being strangled off. So like you say, it does need some element of support just to allow it to exist. Whether that comes from the state or from kind of sponsors or other just general supporters of music, because otherwise people just aren't going to want to spend the money, so people aren't going to make the money.
Exactly that. And I think it's even worse in some cases, such that the sort of young singer-songwriter who desperately wants to land his or her dream can generally only do that if they've already got some private means, you know, some backing within the family who can pay for studio costs, support them whilst they make no money. And while that's you know, no denigration of that fact for them, it is narrowing the window for those who can somehow break into the music scene. And it needn't be that way. It's such a simple thing, not least that now that we have the internet, for someone to play their music to others. But there's this missing piece in the puzzle to actually find a way to monetize that. I don't know whether the figure you're mentioning is the woman who was playing her 10th gig.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yes, no, that was a sort of unfortunate phenomenon insofar as, although she had built up a respectable following online, the fact was she hadn't been out playing music, so She played a couple of gigs by some strange alchemy, one on the new music stage BBC Introducing, and then the next day she appeared early on the other stage, the second biggest stage, and it was manifest that was her 11th gig. Yeah.
So yeah, like you say, I mean, it's difficult to get that experience. You have to have the means, however much enthusiasm you have to have the means to have the equipment to travel.
Yeah.
It's not easy. It's not easy to find that. But hopefully, you know, there can be some kind of renewal of that music scene. Is there anything, you know, I say this as someone who really doesn't know, so I'm possibly throwing my interviewing hook out into the dark, but is there anything that can be done in terms of regulation just to make it easier? Because God knows, if we're just talking about pubs, you mentioned back in the day you could have a band that was just playing in a pub rather than some kind of concert hall. Obviously, we have so much regulation about when they can open, you know, when they can close. And I'm always reading about these clubs in Soho that get these complaints from residents about making any noise after 10 p.m. because people moved into Soho and didn't realize that there might be, you know, louder noise than a cat meowing. They were trying to sleep. So is there anything that can be done just in regulatory terms, do you think, to make life easier for venues and subsequent musicians?
It's a tricky one, because for whatever reason, it's generally the case that a headline act plays at around 9:30 or 10 p.m. That's sort of generally true across the board. So in a pub setting, if you're going to have multiple bands playing, the act most people want to see is probably going to be pushing towards traditional closing time at 11. A lot of pubs are really tied to that, and there's no way of pushing things beyond. So you either have to change the culture of expectation as to when people are going to listen to live music, you know, sort of 7 or 8 p.m. rather than later, or there needs to be a will at the council level to extend late licenses if there's a cultural element, in this case, live music. But if we don't do that, as I say, that there aren't going to be the new venues cropping up for the sort of live music I'm talking about. They're simply not going to be profitable at a small scale. So that they need to be allied to another institution, and the pub is the most obvious one that I can think of.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's where so many great bands have started. You only need to go through all the biographies of any of the well-known rock bands or singer-songwriters. They all started in these grotty little places and then went on to big things. So if you don't have the grotty little places to give them the start, then you don't get the big things later.
Agreed entirely.
And yeah, it's this strange kind of weird, I'm almost tempted to call it a class divide. Like, you do have live music now in the sense of, I've been reading about Taylor Swift's Eras tour. It's like she seems to have made, like, obviously this is an exaggeration, but she seems to have made like hundreds of billions. She's played to half the world and she's visited every capital in the world. And you'd almost look at that and you'd think, wow, this is live music on a scale never seen before. But then there's such a divide between that level of superstardom and then the kind of, I'm doing air quotes, proletariat of the music industry, where it's the struggling bands and singers trying to come up. Do you think there's much prospect for bridging this divide, or are we just going to live in this weird stratified system?
I think you're right that not only is there a divide, but actually that divide is growing. Whether it will keep growing, I don't know, but it's going to take some concerted effort to bridge it. Paradoxically, one of the problems, I think, in the world of streamed music and algorithms promoting different artists based upon what you're listening to, is that sheer diversity of bands and artists you're hearing severs your relationship, your tie to where you are in the world. So back in the day, you might go down the pub, as we were saying, and the support bands will either have the approval of the person who booked the headline act, or the headline act themselves will be touring with the supporters. And by virtue of that, there was a sense of connectedness, and you could see these bands play similar music in the same place. But it's not very good if you're listening to an artist from your country and the next two or three acts that are promoted are based in Italy and in America, because at the scale you're listening to, they're not going to be passing through, you know, Winchester anytime soon. So I do worry about the fact that people's tastes, although that they're as eclectic as ever, you know, it's a great time for finding music, they are divorced from the freedom to wander down the street or get even on the bus and see those bands in person. And unless we find a way to root people into the live music scene of their part of the world, it's hard to see how the bridge will happen.
It's a good point. I mean, there is some extent, it's not a solution, but just as a first step, there is some extent to which we do just have to get up off our asses. I mean, there's live music that happens in my town that I never bother to go along to because I'm sat at home scribbling away and listening to the music of people thousands of kilometers away from me. So I guess to some extent, change does start at home. Yeah, I always like to bring one surprise question on my guests. And as we've been talking about music and music festivals, I did want to ask you, if there was kind of David Stock being held in Butterfield, and you could choose your ideal, let's just say, three headliners. It's a 3-day music event. Who is going to headline at David Stock, which is just your ideal music festival?
And how many people are meant to come to David Stock?
Hundreds of thousands, but somehow they all share your music tastes.
Oh, right. So that sounds both glorious and awful, that many Davids in one place. But let's see. And do the bands have to be active now?
No.
No. Okay, I would have Television from mid-70s. They would be phenomenal. I would have Rites of Spring,
mm-hmm.
Which kicked off the kind of music I'm into in the mid 80s. And then I'd probably have my favorite band that I never was able to see, a band called Areogram from Glasgow. So there's a bit of range there, but these aren't bands that necessarily hundreds of thousands of people are going to be climbing over security fences to see. But
maybe that's the key, as you were saying, to having a, you know, to going back to basics and starting small is having those bands who they might not appeal to the hundreds and thousands, but they appeal to a very dedicated. I mean, it's almost a musical cliche now, but there's the old story about the first, you know, the 300 people who went along to that Sex Pistols gig and everyone started their own band. So maybe that's the most important thing is creating these really dedicated artists and producers and even executives of the future.
That's right. And if you look at the Glastonbury 2023 lineup, no one can look at it and say, this is a brilliant collection of artists. We're all going to Glastonbury to hear these bands and these singers. People are going to Glastonbury either for Glastonbury, whatever that is, or for the club scene, which I think could be duplicated anywhere. So yeah, got to go back to the music.
So we got to wait till, you know, those idealists come along. Maybe not quite the Sex Pistols, but
they're out there.
Inspiration of the future. They're out there, and we're just waiting to hear them. David Butterfield, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben. Pleasure.